Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Chibok girl still missing 2 years later, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's been 2 years since Boko Haram abducted more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria. Ama Ogan has been following every twist and turn in the search for them.
I'm a mother. I have two daughters. I don't know how you cannot place yourself in that position and think, how would I feel? What would I be doing if after 2 years I haven't seen my daughter?
Also, a Pakistani man tries to get off America's so-called kill list.
This is a man who is adamant that he shouldn't be on it and that he's not engaged in violence. If we as the U.S. want to assassinate him, the onus should be on us to show some sort of evidence that we have a right to.
Plus, creating a feminist paradise in a South American jungle. Stories and more today on The World. Glad to have you with us today. Bring back our girls. 2 years later, that global hashtag campaign is still a hope, not a reality. 2 years ago today, 276 girls were kidnapped from a school in Chibok, northern Nigeria. They were taken hostage by the Islamist group Boko Haram. Since then, dozens of these girls have managed to escape, but more than 200 of them are still missing. That's despite the hashtag, the international attention, and repeated promises by the Nigerian government to free the girls. There is fresh hope, though, in the form of a video. I asked my BBC colleague Nkem Ifejika to tell me about that. We reached him out on the streets of Yola, Nigeria.
The American news network CNN has been able to get hold of a video which purports to show 15 of the kidnapped girls. They asked their names. The video has been shown to some parents who do recognize the girls. It was apparently made as a proof-of-life video for any potential negotiation with the Nigerian government. The Nigerian government says that it's trying to verify the authenticity of the video. But as happened last year and as happened the year before, about 2 weeks after the girls were kidnapped, people in Abuja, the capital, marched on Aso Rock, which is where the president lives. They went to make their demands, which has been constant for the past 2 years, because this particular group, the Bring Back Our Girls group, they made the same demand they made last year and the year before, which was that the authorities find those girls and return them back to their parents.
Who released that video, and does it tell us anything about the Chibok girls that we didn't already know?
It doesn't really say much, especially if you cannot verify when that video was taken. If it was indeed taken in December of last year, that is a very strong indication that the girls are still alive, even though there have been suggestions that they've been married off and they've been scattered across the region to Chad, Niger, Cameroon. So in terms of what it actually tells us, perhaps not much. But what it does do for the parents, and the parents that I've spoken to in the past, is it gives them hope, because that's all they've been able to latch onto for the past couple of years, because they've got nothing else. There hasn't been any concrete evidence about the whereabouts of the girls, and hope is what they've always had. And now that hope shines even brighter.
And Kim, there have been lots of other Nigerian girls kidnapped, and some of them have been released. Have those cases helped authorities in zeroing in on the Chibok girls?
Here is the irony of the Chibok girls. The fact that the international community and campaigners within Nigeria made a lot of noise, as it were, and I don't mean that in a derogatory fashion. The fact that they brought it to the world's attention that these girls had been kidnapped, in a sense, made them more valuable to Boko Haram. And Boko Haram would have been reluctant to let them go, perhaps holding on to them as a bargaining chip. Now, with regard to other girls being kidnapped, they're kidnapped in an almost haphazard manner to do things like run the camps, you know, cook food. So there are practical reasons very often. There might be some kind of intelligence which can be gleaned from whatever it is they tell the authorities. But in terms of the wider picture, perhaps not much. And here's the thing. The Chibok girls, 213 of them remain missing. The number of people who've been kidnapped by Boko Haram over the past few years number in the thousands. So the Chibok girls, I suppose, are some kind of symbol which people can latch onto to explain and to understand what is a bigger and wider phenomenon. But quite often, the Chibok girls fade into the background.
My BBC colleague Nkem Ifejika speaking with us from Yola, Nigeria. Let's turn now to Ama Ogan. She's a Nigerian journalist based in South Africa, and she's been keeping a sort of vigil for the missing Chibok girls by writing regular columns about them. Her latest marks this two-year anniversary of their abduction. It's titled Chibok Girls 2 Years in Mind and Still Counting. I asked Ama Ogan for her reaction to the new Proof of Life video we just heard about.
The girls shown on the video look healthy. They look well physically. I was not clear about, it's a small group of the girls compared to the full number. So it's heartening to see that they look so well physically, but there's still so many questions not answered about what their status is, where the rest of them are.
You know, Ama, I'd just like to revisit a few lines you've written over the past 2 years as you've thought about these abductions and tried to wake people up to what's been done or what's not been done. 2 months after the abduction, you wrote, the girl's story has drawn the attention of the world from New York to Cannes. Movie stars, first ladies, school children have tweeted and protested, holding up banners. That, of course, was the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, and no less a figure than Michelle Obama reached out to the world. Noticeably, a month later when you were writing, no mention of Bring Back Our Girls. Do you think the international outrage, in your mind anyway, it lasted only a month?
Well, this is the world we live in. I mean, there's a new outrage that overtakes every week. And it seems to be the way things function now, that something happens, it's big news, everybody makes a lot of noise about it, and then something else takes over. I think there is a value to that kind of campaign, and it's important. But you can't expect to be the most important issue on everybody's mind every day, all the time.
How have these kidnappings, though, played kind of into the minds of Nigerians?
Nigerians were shocked and saddened. I think it's a story that would make anybody weep, really. The idea that young girls at a school getting ready to sit for their final exams would be abducted in the middle of the night. And I would say that for the most part, Nigerians were shocked and saddened by it. People were ashamed of it. They felt, how could this happen? And we must do something about it.
9 months on since the Chibok girls were abducted, and the question is, you write, will some Chibok couples be grandparents without knowing it? Can you explain that?
These abductions have led to forced marriages and rape. These are the reports we've had. And the Chibok abductions were not the first. Boko Haram had been carrying on this kind of campaign, I think almost up to 2 years before the Chibok girls occurred. A number of newspapers in Nigeria that had run stories on women who'd escaped, and the girl who had escaped spoke about their experiences being forced into marriage. So it seemed to me that given what had happened to these Chibok girls, we could not discount the fact that they may have been treated in the same way, especially since a leader of Boko Haram announced that shortly after they had been taken that they would marry them off and convert them to Islam.
Ama, as a Nigerian writer in South Africa, how often in the past 2 years have you found yourself placing yourself in the shoes of those Chibok parents?
I'm a mother. I have 2 daughters. I don't know how you cannot place yourself in that position and think, how would I feel? What would I be doing if after 2 years I haven't seen my daughter? I don't know what's happened to her.
So, Ama, I know you're a parent, but can you explain why you were so taken and sucked into the story from the very start, from day one?
I don't know how you can't be. I don't know how you can't be. I was living outside Nigeria, and I suppose sometimes when you're outside looking in, things have a particular sharpness for you. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I don't know that I'm any more involved in it than other people who have taken this up as a crusade. I'm somebody who's trying to urge people to, you know, keep on focusing on it and hoping that something will be done, something effective and conclusive.
Ama Ogan is a journalist based in Johannesburg. She's been following the case of the kidnapped girls from Chibok since they were taken exactly 2 years ago today. Ama, great to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The ongoing drama with the Chibok girls highlights a sad reality. Young children, especially girls, are often targeted for abuse by fighters, and not just in Nigeria. Diane Mazurana studies this. She's an associate professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
So where we have situations in which girls are explicitly targeted and targeted for a purpose of sexual violence, there's a pretty clear pattern as to what they are likely to experience. groups like Boko Haram, other groups like the Lord's Resistance Army, and more than a dozen that I can name that practice this, would be looking for girls as rewards for fighters, but primarily for commanders. There would be a divvying up of the girls, maybe based on rank, maybe based on something more abstract. Those girls would be given to commanders, and they would be what we're calling forced wives. So they would be forced into marriage. They would be subjected to constant rape. They would be physically abused. They would be mentally abused. There might be forced impregnation, forced childbearing. We've certainly recorded that girls who are given as forced wives, if they try to control their reproduction or they try to prevent pregnancies, can be severely punished even by death. So we can expect in such situations that these girls will have experienced a range of forms of sexual and physical and emotional violence, and that that's very much part of the strategy of the group.
These girls, these women, they're not carrying guns. They're not the enemy. These Chibok girls were studying in a classroom. What is the point of sexual violence in conflict? Why do you think power is used in this sexual way?
Sexual violence in conflict happens for a variety of reasons. But if we look at the case of Boko Haram, we can see it as a retaliatory measure against both the government and the communities that Boko Haram is trying to control. So in that sense, it's a way to terrorize populations into behaving the way you want. But also, it's about building up your own group and rewarding your commanders and keeping that group intact.
As you've been talking, I'm kind of going back to some facts and myths of sexual and gender-based violence that you published that I found really helpful. For example, one myth, wartime rape is most pervasive in Africa. Fact is, the highest levels of reported rape during your study period happen in Europe. I mean, it really feels like we are so far away from understanding sexual violence in war and how to deal with it.
I think we're getting better at understanding. And the kind of facts and myths information comes from a great trio of researchers, Green, Woods, and Cohen. And what they have really done is looked large scale at some data to kind of explode some myths about sexual violence. One is that it's more likely to be rebel forces that rape. In fact, it's more likely to be government forces. Another one is that rape is ubiquitous. All groups are using it. No, in fact, a number of cases, groups don't use sexual violence. So what we're trying to understand more is, and I think the hopeful message is, if there are groups that are not using sexual violence, we know that you can prevent it and that armed groups cannot use it. So we need to know more about what's going on internally in command and control that either inhibits or enables the use of sexual violence and to target efforts that way.
What do you think is the one way that you feel has not really been tapped that needs some exposure, needs some light of day on how to prevent sexual violence during wartime?
I mean, I think one of the things that needs to happen is beyond the incredible important work of the International Committee of the Red Cross, who does engage with non-state armed groups, there needs to be much more willingness to engage with non-state armed groups and also state forces explicitly on this topic. In my opinion, we need to make the use of sexual violence as repulsive, repugnant, and with as much international outcry as the use of biological weapons.
How do you do that?
I think through a lot of attention to it and understanding that it is possible to stop, prevent, and address this, and for groups to realize that the use of this as a weapon of war or opportunistically because they don't really care about what their soldiers are doing, whatever, go ahead. I think we need to make it really clear to them that this kind of behavior is absolutely unacceptable and there will be a swift response. And I think also, you know, many of the Western governments are training these national militaries. They are arming them. This needs to be a priority for training those professional armies.
Diane Mazzarana at Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Your Brain on LSD, coming up on The World. Shopping for a sperm donor is not like shopping for anything else. You don't get to know what, or rather who, the source is of the product in question, and you don't know precisely what it will bring. But you get some clues of the source, height, hair color, things like that. But what if the information is wrong? Prospective parents in Canada were told that a sperm donor, known only as donor 9623, was healthy and educated. Turns out the donor was a convicted felon with multiple diagnoses of mental illness. So now three Canadian families have launched lawsuits against the U.S. Sperm Bank and the Ontario company that distributed the sperm. The World's One Woman Canada desk, Andrea Crossan, has been following the story. So how was donor 9623 actually advertised, Andrea?
He was sold as being somebody who was very musical, very emotionally intelligent, and also of somebody who has a really high IQ. Donors were told that he had an IQ of 160, which is comparable to Einstein and Stephen Hawking. He also had an undergraduate degree in neuroscience and a master's degree in artificial intelligence.
All right, sounds like somebody you'd want as a dad. And the reality?
The reality, Marco, is that this man has a long history of mental health issues, including schizophrenia, drug-induced psychotic disorder, and significant grandiose delusions. He also has a criminal record. He was charged with burglary in 2005 and spent 8 months in jail.
So how did all this come to light?
Well, the company at the center of this, the sperm donor company Zytex, it accidentally revealed the donor's name by including him in an email that it sent to a donor family in Canada, Angie Collins and Beth Hansen of Port Hope, Ontario. They found out all the information about this donor. A lot of this was really painful news. Mm. Here's Angie Collins speaking earlier this week on the CBC program As It Happens about her feelings towards the sperm donor.
My heart goes out to him. This can't be easy to deal with. Poor choice, though, to knowingly donate sperm when you contain genetic material for debilitating illnesses. But he wasn't healthy at the time that he was making these decisions.
Andrea, what is the difference in the vetting process between U.S. and Canadian sperm banks?
Well, here's the thing. Canadian sperm banks are filled with U.S. sperm. It is incredibly difficult for Canadian men to donate sperm. It is something that you cannot be compensated for. So, you know, in the U.S., if a man wants to donate sperm, there is payment involved.
Right.
In Canada, you cannot receive any money. It's also difficult. There are a lot of medical tests. So in Canada, in these sperm donation banks, it's all American sperm.
That's incredible. So medically speaking, do we know what the likelihood is of the children issued from this donor? Will they also turn out to present signs of mental illness at some point?
Well, this is what this lawsuit is about. These children are all under the age of 12. A lot of the symptoms that would come with something like schizophrenia, they don't present until the child is older, possibly late teens, early 20s. So the families are seeking to have Zytex establish a medical fund to cover the cost of monitoring the children for psychosis. Now, Zytex maintains that the 7-year-old child at the center of the lawsuit is completely healthy right now, and it's adamant that it's done nothing wrong. To some extent, it's an honor system. They ask these questions. They ask donors, do you have a history of schizophrenia? If a donor says no, they have to go with that.
It really sounds like there are a lot of issues Canadian families deal with that we don't have to deal with when it comes to this here in the United States. Do you know any families in Canada who have been through this process, and what did they experience?
Well, last summer, I was reporting on this story in Toronto, and I met a family there. A friend of theirs had offered to donate sperm. They ended up not even doing that through a clinic because that was very expensive.
Mm.
So they kind of just circumvented this whole system.
Freelanced it.
They did.
The World's One Woman Canada desk, Andrea Crossan, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm guessing a lot of you remember this old PSA, the one where a man fries an egg to make a point about drugs.
This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Actually, yes, still lots of questions, at least for researchers at Imperial College London. They wanted to know more about what goes on inside the brain of someone on LSD. And now we know. They found that LSD causes areas of the brain that are normally isolated from each other to start communicating. That explains the hallucinations. If you're wondering what we gain from that knowledge, just listen to Amanda Fielding of the Beckley Foundation. She co-directed the study and says LSD could help with mental illness.
When we're talking psychotherapy, they are beneficial because it's these fixed networks which have become rigid, which perpetuate the kind of protection of the trauma. And by them breaking down, the kind of fluidity which follows the breakdown has a lasting effect. And I would very much expect it to open the doors to being able to use LSD and other psychedelics as aids to psychotherapy.
Yeah, is there a shift in attitudes going on generally with psychedelics? I know there's been a lot of interest in the South American culture of ayahuasca, which is this plant root that causes intense hallucinations and actually apparently has an ability to address a whole range of psychological ailments, including PTSD.
Yes, and there is a resurgence, and I'm delighted to be a leading part of this resurgence because these substances have for millennia, apart from LSD, which is relatively new, they have a history of being therapeutically incredibly valuable. And also, I think they have all sorts of other advantages of self-revelation and the mystical experience, a very wide spectrum of benefits.
You know, Amanda Fielding, a lot of scientists feel a necessity for a full understanding of their field to experience themselves what they study. Have you ever taken LSD, and how did it benefit you?
Yes, I took LSD. I first took it in 1965 before it was illegal. And that is what made me really dedicate most of my working life to getting scientific research done into it, because I think it's such a valuable compound. Because the interesting thing is, I think, is that by breaking down the networks, the domination of certain networks and the brain becoming more unified, the me-mine aspect of the personality dissolves into more a feeling of unity with the world.
So Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane, when she proposed dosing Richard Nixon with LSD and making him see the world a little differently, diluting the ego, so she had some some scientific grounding for that proposal.
Absolutely. And I mean, what we are doing is researching it with the very latest neuroscientific knowledge and brain imaging technology. And that is enabling us to see what are the neurobiological correlates of what people are experiencing. So people have been expressing what they've been experiencing from William James, and Aldous Huxley put it very beautifully. And what our research is doing is showing empirically what's happening in the brain.
Amanda Fielding of the Beckley Foundation speaking with us from Oxford, telling us about the imaging study she co-directed on the effect of LSD on the brain. Ms. Fielding, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Milana Weintraub plays a saleswoman in the AT&T commercials. She's also a former refugee, and that's why she decided to help others on a recent trip to Greece.
You see someone so grateful to be alive, and you think about how lucky we are to take being alive for granted.
Milana Weintraub's Can't Do Nothing campaign, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Stop trying to kill me. That is the message from Malik Jalal to the U.S. government. Malik Jalal is from northern Waziristan. That's a part of Pakistan on the border with Afghanistan. And a series of close calls from drone attacks have led him to believe that he's on America's so-called kill list. But he claims he's not a threat to anyone, that it's all a misunderstanding. Jennifer Gibson is with the British charity Reprieve in London, and she represents Jalal. I know Jalal is in London this week. Jennifer, can you tell us why?
He's come to Britain basically to try to see if the British government will weigh in on his behalf with the Americans. He sees Britain as very closely aligned with the U.S. And when he couldn't get the U.S. to listen, thought his best approach was to try to come here to Britain and see if the British could get the Americans to listen.
So how is Malik Jalal's belief that he's being targeted affecting his everyday life?
The targeting of Malik Jalal has had a dramatic impact on his life. He's had to resort to eventually moving his entire family out of their homeland and where they live to the more settled areas of Pakistan, a town called Peshawar. because he was terrified that in trying to kill him, the Americans were going to accidentally kill his family, his wife, his children. And he tells a very powerful story of the kind of deciding point that made him eventually move them out of North Waziristan. He came home one night and the drones were circling overhead. And instead of sleeping at home, he thought, I better move. I better go sleep under a tree because I don't know why the drones are overhead. I don't know if they're going to strike. And I'm worried if they strike my house right now, they're going to kill my children. So he quietly left the house. He didn't tell his family why he was leaving. He just said he was going for a walk. And he walked out to a nearby tree. And he turned around once he got to the tree, and his son had followed him out, his young son, Halal. And he said to Halal, go back to the house. There's nothing to worry about. And Halal said, what do you mean there's nothing to worry about? And he said, well, the drones don't kill children. You'll be fine. Go back to the house. And his little son looked at him and said, but I know they kill children. I've seen them kill children with drones. So how can you say that if I go back to the house, I'll be safe? And I think at that point, Malik Jalal kind of realized that he couldn't keep his family in North Waziristan anymore. So for their safety, he picked them up and moved them outside of their home.
What an intense exchange. Let's explore just for a moment why Jalal may be targeted by U.S. drone strikes. I mean, he's one of the leaders of a group called the North Waziristan Peace Committee, or NWPC. What does this group do, and is this why he's being targeted?
He believes this is why he's being targeted. So the North Waziristan Peace Committee is a Pakistani government-sanctioned group that was set up in 2006 to effectively negotiate and maintain peace between the Pakistani government and the various tribes and groups that live in this part of Pakistan, North Waziristan. Whenever disputes arise, when the peace looks to be breaking down, when one side gets mad with the other, they go out and they start talking to people and they settle the disputes. At least one of those groups that the Pakistani government frequently negotiates with and which the NWPC was tasked with negotiating with is a group the U.S. is known to have targeted on a regular basis and that the U.S. reportedly believes to be an enemy. Basically, what Malik Jalal will tell you is, you know, my job as a tribal elder is to negotiate and resolve disputes. And in order to do that, you have to talk to people.
But the U.S. believes the NWPC is actually a front for other activities.
Yeah. So one of the rumors is that the U.S. believes that the NWPC is potentially a front for some of these groups. The NWPC is adamant that it's not. I go back to the fact that this is a Pakistani government-sanctioned group.
But we've also heard a lot of stories that the Pakistani government has been funding the Taliban. So, I mean, how can you be sure that the NWPC is not a front for other activities? I mean, what is your relationship with Malik Jalal that leads you to believe he's being unfairly targeted?
We've known Malik Jalal for a while now, for quite a while. We've spent a lot of time talking to him. He's been a very outspoken critic of what's going on in the region. You know, I think the better question is, doesn't he have a right to know whether he's on a kill list? He's come here into Britain. He sent a letter to the British government. He sent it to the U.S. embassy and said, if you want to question me, please come question me. And the onus then, if we as the U.S. want to assassinate him, the onus should be on us to show some sort of evidence that we have a right to.
Jennifer Gibson of the charity Reprieve. She represents Malik Jalal, a Pakistani who says he is being targeted by the U.S. drone program. Jennifer, thanks very much for your time.
No problem.
We reached out to the State Department about Malik Jalal, and an official there gave us a statement which said, in part, we face real terrorist threats and will continue to take action to address them in a way that is consistent with and guided by the law and our values. Just 4 months before hosting the world's biggest sporting event, the state government of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil says it's broke. Teachers, cops, and doctors in Rio haven't been paid in weeks, and basic services are starting to fall apart. It doesn't bode well for all the visitors expected there for this summer's Olympic Games, but more importantly, Rio residents are worried about what all this means for them. Students in particular are staging a protest. They've occupied several high schools across Rio in solidarity with their teachers and to demand a better education. Will Carlos of our Global Post team went to meet some of them.
There are no leaders at the occupied high schools in Rio de Janeiro. Or rather, all the students are leaders. The idea of a hierarchical leadership system is entirely outmoded to these 15, 16 and 17-year-olds. But when I enter the occupied Colégio Gomes Freire de Andrade in Rio's Peña neighbourhood and ask who I should talk to, eyes turn instantly to Arthur César. He's a 17-year-old with a close-shaven head, coal black eyes, and a sporadic grin. I ask César how long he and the others are willing to stay here at the school.
Tem alguma ideia?
Olha, ideia nenhuma.
Look, I have no idea, no idea at all.
Enquanto o nosso,
we feel like, while the powers that be still refuse to meet with us, we'll continue.
César lives nearby in this tough, crime-ridden Rio neighborhood. He's just one of scores of high school students who recently launched this occupation campaign against endless budget cuts to an already dismal state education system.
As escolas são todas no mesmo barco, acho que são vistas como, acho que o lixo da sociedade.
Public schools are seen basically as society's trash. Wherever the politicians can take money out of the budget, they're going to take it. They just won't take it from private schools.
The students here and at some 20 other occupied state-run schools have placed their own padlocks on the school gates. They're now living and sleeping where once they merely studied. César says they're fighting today so that future generations of students can enjoy a better education, one that might help them escape the drugs and violence all around them.
Olha, é muito importante sim, sobre os meus olhos.
Look, yeah, it's really important. In my view, you have to study so that young people in these communities can avoid marginalization, the world of drugs, crime. I think that, at least for the last 40, 50 years, the best way out is to study, to have knowledge. When you no longer want knowledge, you're no longer alive.
Arthur lays out some of the students' demands: an improved curriculum, a more democratic school system, reinstatement of essentials like guards at the school gates, and, of course, that their teachers actually get paid from now on. But while he's thinking about the future, part of César's heart dwells in the past. In the long hours the students have to while away here, they're doing what teenagers do everywhere: picking up guitars, writing songs, and singing. And for César, the music that resonates most are the angry, politicized songs of the mid-1980s, when Brazil was just transitioning from dictatorship to democracy. In the school's main common room, César groups the students together in a circle and launches into the 1985 classic Será by post-punk rockers Legião Urbana, or Urban Legion.
Eu não pertenço a você, não é me dominando assim, que você vai me entender.
The lyrics are strangely fitting 30 years on. Take your hands off me. I am not your property. It is not by keeping me under control that you will ever understand me. César and his fellow students may not know how long they'll occupy their school, but they are clear about this. Rio's schools are public property, they say. As such, they own the floor they're sitting on, the rickety fan that struggles to cool them, and the kitchen where someone's cooking food for 60 hungry teenagers. César says they'll keep the doors locked until there's actual, tangible reform of an education system they say is failing them. And in the meantime, they'll keep singing. For the World, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
Ficaremos acordados, imaginando alguma solução para que esse nosso egoísmo.
We're going to take a turn now to talk about Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Gilman was born in 1860. She was a trailblazing feminist. Her views were so forward-thinking, they would not be out of place today. But even Gilman couldn't have foreseen that 100 years after she wrote her book, Her Land, about a feminist paradise deep in the jungle, someone would try to bring it to life. Here's Alina Simone.
Kate White has already sold or given away most of her things. Except for a couple of Coleman camping tables, her living room is bare. But boxes, filled with supplies for her new life, arrive at her apartment in Fresno every few days.
We have tents, lanterns, solar-powered things. This was supposed to arrive Wednesday.
This time, a hatch for the camper she intends to tow from California to, well, she's not sure exactly.
You can't just look at a map and go, yeah, there, and say that's the exact location. You need to go and find out, ooh, that place is too muddy.
See, Kate is a pioneer of Her Land, a Facebook group of 5,000-plus members. Their plan is to create an eco-commune inspired by the land without hymns, described in the novel Her Land.
It wasn't just, oh, here's a book, let's pretend we're in the book. It's using the book as sort of a design document.
Like the book, Her Land is envisioned as a cashless society supported by permaculture farming, based in an undisclosed region of South America. But this Her Land offers a postmodern coda. No men are allowed, but trans people are welcome. The commune will provide internet access and Kindle libraries. They envision being able to one day 3D print necessary supplies. The biggest difference between the movement and the book? The pioneers insist this Her Land isn't just science fiction. Next month, Kate's giving up her apartment and heading south in the truck and camper the group purchased after 2 years of saving.
So this is basically going to be your home for a number of months.
Yes. And it's comfortable for plenty of people. And you can hear that it has a pretty big engine, which is necessary in order to carry so much.
Once she reaches South America by road and ferry, she will meet up with a handful of European Her Land pioneers. Their ultimate destination is somewhere in the jungle on the border of Guyana and Venezuela.
It is an area that is uninhabited, so we're not pushing anyone out. And it's warm enough that we don't have to worry about freezing and those sorts of things. So it's a very friendly area for living.
The Her Landers won't say exactly where it is, just that they've secured an agreement with the relevant government.
And once we're there, we will then sit down and start building.
We can do whatever we want, 'cause this is a man-free zone.
The idea of an eco-feminist commune sounds radical, but it's actually nothing new. In the 1970s and 80s, separatist communities known as women's lands, that's women with a Y, sprang up throughout the rural U.S. and Canada, inspired by the women's liberation movement.
Sisterhood is powerful! Join us now! Sisterhood is powerful! Join us now!
Krissa Cummings is a resident of one of the last of these communities, Subama, the Susan B. Anthony Memorial Unrest Home. Located on 150 acres in Ohio, it was established back in 1979, a time when
jobs were still listed in papers as women's jobs and men's jobs. And so a lot of it was just taking a look at the way oppression was affecting women.
But in an age when Caitlyn Jenner's on the cover of Vanity Fair and Hillary Clinton is a front-runner candidate for president,
I mean, there's most of the women's lands in the country either have no residents or only a single resident.
Subama has five, which makes it one of the more successful feminist retreats. For Her Landers like Kate, though, not much has changed since 1979. The man is still the man.
For every step we fight to go forward, we get pushed backwards further. There's only so much freedom that they will allow us to have.
But according to Krissa, when you're living on a feminist commune, freedom isn't necessarily the operative word.
I will say that having it be women only can be very challenging personally. Like, I struggle with how it limits my ability to have male visitors here. It's a lot like being in a marriage, quite frankly.
The feminist utopia Gilman describes in the book Her Land lasts for 2,000 years. For me, standing next to the truck parked outside Kate's apartment, it's still an open question whether this Her Land will get off the ground. But for Kate, at least, there's no turning back.
This has been my dream all my life. People don't plan on giving up their dreams, and I don't. I don't plan on coming back.
As Charlotte Perkins Gilman once said, to attain happiness in another world, we need only believe something, while to secure it in this world, we must do something. For The World, this is Alina Simone, Fresno, California.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. You probably know of Milana Weintraub, though maybe not her name. She's the perky sales associate in a series of ads for AT&T, always ready with the perfect comeback.
It's how we show appreciation.
You know, I really appreciate that you appreciate me as a customer.
And we appreciate how much you appreciate us appreciating our customers.
But what caught our attention about Milana Weintraub is the foundation she's launched. It's called Can't Do Nothing. The goal is to raise awareness about the plight of refugees worldwide and get people to help them. The idea came to Milana after she went to Greece on vacation last summer with her father. That was at the same time that thousands of Syrian refugees were streaming into Greece from Turkey. But Weintraub says she really didn't know much about that before landing in Greece.
Like a lot of people in my circle, in my world, I wasn't really aware of what was going on there, and I didn't really feel comfortable asking questions because a lot of the times it seems like something that you should know more about.
Once in Greece, though, she quickly realized she was in the midst of a crisis, and it touched her personally because Milana Weintraub herself was once a refugee. Her family fled from Uzbekistan back in 1989 when she was just a toddler. They eventually made their way to California. So when Weintraub saw what was happening in Greece, she decided to do something about it. She and a friend volunteered to help Syrian refugees arriving on the island of Lesbos. She also filmed the experience and published a short video documentary on YouTube. Weintraub says what she saw was unforgettable.
There's no way to prepare yourself for seeing someone touch safe land for the first time in who knows how long, in weeks or months. So that's definitely a shift in perspective when you see someone so grateful to be alive and you think about how lucky we are to take being alive for granted. And the nonprofits and independent volunteers that were there were definitely providing a hand, you know, people like me who were offering rides and sandwiches and clothes. But we were only one stop on their very long journey to wherever we'll accept them, wherever they could find a home.
I mean, you weren't just an observer as a camera, as you kind of indicate. You volunteered. But how did you know, like, what to do?
I didn't know what to do. I just knew I couldn't do nothing. I actually just kind of went over there fairly blind. I met a nurse who literally just dropped a point on my GPS on my phone. And the next morning at 5 a.m., my friend and I drove out there, and we just started seeing volunteers. One of the most surprising things was how easy it was to get involved and help.
You obviously do your best, as we see, to help out. But did it ever feel kind of futile handing out your limited supply of bananas and fruit and sandwiches?
No, I do understand how it could feel like a drop in the bucket. But it felt good and it felt right to help someone, even if it was a small gesture.
I know you were really young when you came from Uzbekistan. Did any of this remind you, though, of the past?
Seeing the families really reminded me of my family. You know, seeing a young mom. My mom was 19 when she had me. And seeing her walk miles with her child, that definitely struck a chord, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the first things you see is this boat that arrives on the shores of Lesbos. And these people then have to take off on a two-hour hike after all of this stuff. Just to get to a camp.
Not even to get to a camp, but to get to a bus stop that would take them to another bus stop that would take them to a camp depending
right.
on where they were from. But that's also why the small gesture of passing out dry shoes was really great. If you can imagine going on a two-hour hike with wet sneakers, what that does to your feet. So helping out in those small ways really had a big impact.
So after that trip to Greece and making this mini-doc, you decided to launch the organization Can't Do Nothing. What is the goal?
The goal of Can't Do Nothing is really just to empower people to make the change they want to see in the world. It's asking you what matters to you, what are you going to do about it. Right now, the goal is really centered around refugees, but it's really a gateway to help people to discover ways to take action. And sometimes it could feel hard to know how to help, that the issue can appear bigger than you. So I made this little website that offers you simple ways to share your time, your money, or your voice.
CantDoNothing.org.
Yeah.
This launched in January.
Mm-hmm.
How have things been going since then?
Amazing. Considering it's only been about 2.5 months, it's been really amazing. We've been able to sponsor classrooms in refugee camps. We've been able to hire full-time teachers. We've given, in partnership with the organizations that we are working with, over 150 children prescription eyeglasses, a first aid center in Lesbos. We've sponsored an emergency medical vehicle. So, it started as a little YouTube video, and it's having a a really tremendous ripple effect. So really great.
Have you been keeping up with the news since you've been back from Lesbos? I'm just curious what you think of this new EU policy that sends refugees back to Turkey.
I think it's unfortunate for these people. I wish there were better systems in place for people fleeing a war zone. And as an organization, we're not making any kind of political statement. What Can't Do Nothing would like to do is help the people. So one of the organizations that we're working with is the Syria Fund that's providing education to the children in the refugee camps. And we have to think about what the situation will look like, what the lives of these people will look like 10 years down the line.
Looking 10 years down the line, I mean, it's kind of instructive because, you know, look at you now. I mean, you and your family were welcomed as refugees here in the U.S. How do you feel about people who say the U.S. shouldn't let any refugees into the country?
I would urge those people to remember that the folks that they're talking about are human beings, often with families and hopes, ambitions, and a need for a home, just the same as us.
Your parents, are they still in California?
No, my dad lives in Moscow and my mom lives in Van Nuys. Yeah, she lives just a little bit away from me.
And what do they think about this? I mean, they must have some thoughts since they too were refugees at one point.
Well, when I first went to Lesbos, I left vacation with my dad and I didn't tell him I was going because he wouldn't think it was safe. And he was right. So right before I released the documentary, I sent him a cut and I told him and I apologized and he said he was really proud of my sneaky heart.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He might have stopped you, but good thing you went ahead and did it.
Yeah. I think all in all, he likes my sense of doing the right thing, or maybe he's just proud that I got away with a lie.
A good lie. Milana Weintraub, great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks.
You could sit in front of your TV for days waiting for that AT&T spot where Milana Weintraub is speaking her native Uzbek, or just pop over right now to PRI.org and check that out, along with Milana's short documentary about helping refugees on Lesbos. It's definitely worth a few minutes of your time. Again, that's all at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.